the Pesach Seder. There is not a more familiar Jewish observance, not an observance which is more primal from our youth, with all of the primal associations, the associations from our youth, the comfort of the familiar. At the same time, we feel a deep need for the Seder to grow with us, to find some new revelation, compelling revelation, so we could own the Seder of old with fresh eyes. Let's begin with the notion of reframing. Reframing is a buzzword today. It's a modern, contemporary concept. The promise that we can take negative experiences of our past, memories which perhaps weigh heavily on us, and we can do something positive with them. We can look at them from a different perspective, find a more redemptive perspective. So these demons of the past won't be demons anymore. While this is a modern contemporary concept, I posit it is an ancient Torah concept as well, and one which we will see permeates the Seder and the observances which we know so well. To take a step back, when classical Jewish sources such as Ramchal seek to address the existential question of human suffering, they point out that the true clarity, the true ability to deal with human suffering will only be realized at the end of days, when the prophets tell us that at that time we will somehow look back on everything which happened and we will say, ah, now I get it. Everything which made no sense, everything which seems so painful, now I get it. Then at the end of days, we will be able to say, thank you, as Yeshaya says, for everything which happened. Now, the suggestion that you can take an event such as the Holocaust, or forget the Holocaust, think about deep personal suffering, the suggestion that eventually we'll be able to come to terms with it is difficult for us to accept. Perhaps we cringe at even the suggestion, and instinctually we respond, one dare not suggest that redemptive meaning could be found. And it is in fact true that with the limited tools we have of this lifetime, we cannot, we dare not claim to be able to make sense of human suffering such as this. However, with the profundity of faith that we are experiencing a very small slice of reality, a very small piece of the puzzle of Hashem's reality, and there are other pieces and other components which will come to bear. And then in the end, we will just see everything with a very different perspective and with very different assumptions. And thereby we will be able to accept a loving God who ensures that everything which happens is ultimately loving. That is a very, very comforting notion. That while we cannot connect the dots today, the knowledge that we will be able to do so, and even deeper, that there's a loving God at work, this promise of reframing at the time of Geula is very, very powerful as we live through the Geulas. Well, I would posit that while it is true that absolute reframing, the ability to truly make sense of human suffering, can only happen at the end of days. On a smaller scale, when we experience Geula redemption in this world. While we can't per se justify the previous suffering, we at least can refrain and come to appreciate redemptive characteristics to the Geulas of the past in a way which we could not when we were engulfed by the Geulas itself. So when we think about the first Geulas of the Jewish people, Mitzrayim, it would be insensitive to tell our ancestors laboring under the bricks and mortar, this is really good. This really has redemptive qualities. But you and I sitting down to a Seder, looking back, we can, and it is our mandate, at the time of Geula, in the celebration of Geula, to embrace even past suffering with newfound perspective, with meaning, because meaning, you understand, is the key. That is really what we seek. I have oftentimes suggested that the most painful element of atheism, aside from the fact that as a mom and as a believer in Hashem, I believe that an atheist is not in touch with truth, but on a human level, I find the most painful aspect of atheism the conclusion that one's personal suffering is in vain. The atheist ultimately has nothing to do with personal suffering. I am simply a conglomeration of cells wandering through this universe, and suffering is just a dead end. That is a... The depression of that perspective is engulfing. The notion that there is meaning in my suffering, there is meaning in all of our personal sufferings, there is meaning in our national sufferings as a Jewish people, as a humanity, which we can begin to embrace at the time of Geula as we do at the Seder, is critical to our ability to live through Geulas and the vicissitudes of this life in a way which is inspiring, in a way which we can be proud of. So let's sink our teeth right into it. This Seder of old, and see how the notion of reframing demons of the past pervasively permeates the Seder. We are well aware that at the Seder, we do not only celebrate the redemption of leaving Mitzrayim, but we no less commemorate the painful memories of the bricks and the mortar, of our babies, of our infants crushed into bricks. As the Mishnah mandates, maschil bignus, we begin by dwelling on the disgraces of our history, the disgraceful periods of our history. And only then, misayim b'shvach, we conclude with the praiseworthy aspects of Geula. Appreciate the power of this expression, maschil bignus, begin by dwelling on the disgraces. We don't sugarcoat disgraces. We don't try to run away from disgraceful memories. We stare it down. We think about it. We take stock of the disgraces of the past at the Seder, no less than the celebrations. And we do something positive with it. Now, perhaps because we are so familiar with the Seder, we kind of take for granted this powerful experience of commemorating suffering and salvation side by side. But the young child, with no preconceived notions, does not take this for granted. When the child asks the Manash Tana, explains the Abarbanel, you know what's really bothering the child? The child is trying to make sense out of seemingly contradictory behaviors, or behaviors he doesn't know how to synthesize. Some of the behaviors of the Seder night, which he's asking about, are celebratory, such as reclining. Some of the behaviors are mourning behaviors, eating bitter herbs, eating myrrh. And what the child is really confused because suffering and salvation, positive and negative sort of behaviors, experiences are taking place simultaneously. Well, we understand that this confused child actually is right on the money. He gets it. The duality of commemorating suffering and salvation is what the night is all about, and it is the congruence of the two, the living the two together, the finding meaning in past memories, which are stigma invoking until we do something with it, with them, along with the celebration. Therein lies the secret of the Seder. We are not simply discussing the past as a means to thereby appreciate why the redemption is so important. The gullus of the past is not simply a ladder to be thrown away once we arrive at the destination, the ge'ula. The child gets it. We're harping and we're focusing on the gullus as much as the ge'ula, because we can do something positive with the ge'ula, with the gullus, now that we are living the ge'ula. Perhaps the clearest demonstration of this marriage, of this fusion between gullus and ge'ula, and the creative genius of the Jewish people to do this, lies in the way we eat the Karban Pesach. The Torah tells us, eat the Karban Pesach along with both matzah and maror. Al matzos umrorim yochlohu. That here the Lamb of Redemption, on one hand we eat with matzah, which commemorates the hasty redemption, but no less we eat it with the maror, with the bitter herbs, commemorating the pain of the gullus. We eat it all together. We ingest it all together. Pesach, matzah, maror. And if that was not provocative enough, think of the korech sandwich of Hillel that Hillel instructs us at the Seder, based on a literal read of the pasuk, al matzos umrorim yochluhu. Eat the matzah, Pesach, matzah, maror together as a sandwich. What is this behavior all about? Aside from a practically difficult observance, certainly struggling today with hard, flat matzah to create a sandwich of sorts. Other than a logistical difficulty, what is the meaning? What is the concept of the korech sandwich? Sandwiching together the matzah, the commemoration of hasty redemption, with the maror, the bitter herbs, and eating them as one time, as one taste, is exactly what the Seder is all about. The maror and the matzah must be blended, must be fused. We taste them together because the gullus, the ge'ula perspective, the redemptive perspective of ge'ula must inform now the way we approach the gullus, the way we approach the memories of the past. They won't weigh upon us heavily. They will be able to find fulfillment, meaning, in a way which gives us the ability to cope with the past and even to be inspired by the past. Think about how we grew, how the national psyche of the Jewish people grew within the slavery, within the servitude, and now allows us to be a thriving, free people, a Torah people, and therefore sandwich the maror right in, together with the other foods, a celebration. Sandwiching here is a celebration of fusion, of synthesis, of bringing it all together. And the truth is, as we take a step back and look for this notion of reframing the past, or fusion of past suffering with present salvation and finding the healthy marriage of the between the two, we find it all over the place. Think about the matzah itself. What does the matzah commemorate? So on one hand, we know the matzah commemorates hasty redemption, the fact that they were banished, they were thrown out of Egypt before there was time for their dough to rise. But there's another aspect to the matzah. Matzah is called lechem oni, poor man's bread, to remember the poverty, the conditions of deprivation in Mitzrayim. How interesting it must have been to a Jewish people that the food of their celebration of hasty redemption is actually the substance, the fare of their slavery. In modern day parlance, that would be akin to if a prisoner would take the striped suit of the jail or the orange jumpsuit and take that prisoner garb and then unfurl it when he is let go. As the flag of triumph. The flag of triumph is the prisoner garb, is the orange jumpsuit. If a prisoner would really be able to do that, think about that prisoner. Raising aloft his orange jumpsuit now in triumph, how he is taking all of the past and saying, I can own it, I can embrace it, I could appreciate how now that orange jumpsuit has become a symbol of redemption. I have grown with that orange jumpsuit. This is exactly the secret of the matzah. And the Torah directly points to this synthesis of the matzah. The Torah tells us, in Parashas Re'eh, Tochal olav matzos lechem oni, eat the matzah, the poor man's bread. Why? Ki b'chipazon yatzasim Mitzrayim, because you left Egypt in a haste. The Torah is, in the same breath, speaking of matzah as lechem oni, poor man's bread, and then speaking of matzah as the bread of hasty redemption. Eat the poor man's bread because you left Egypt in a haste. When we have left Egypt in a haste, we are able to actually eat the poor man's bread, imbibe, ingest, make a part of us, rather than divorcing ourselves from the past. Could have we asked for a more primal symbol of fusion, of blending, than the basic mitzvah of matzah? It is all right there. And at the Seder, when we designate the matzah as the centerpiece of the Seder, Lechem She'onan Alav Dvarim Harbei, the matzah is called the centerpiece of the Haggadah. We notice how both characteristics of the matzah with its orange jumpsuit, you might say, connotation, the poor man's bread, and all those miserable memories of the slavery, along with the later meaning it takes on, both are expressed on that same piece of matzah. Because in the beginning of the Haggadah, what do we say? We say, Ha lach ma'anya. This is poor man's bread. We point at the matzah and we say, this is poor man's bread. But then at the end of the makid, we say, Matzah zu, this matzah, is the bread of hasty redemption. Hear the echo. This matzah, this bread. In the beginning we said, this is the bread of our poverty, halach ma'anya. And then we say, this is the bread of hasty redemption. So which one is this matzah? Clearly both. These two notes in the Haggadah Symphony, the bread of poverty, the bread of hasty redemption, these seemingly different tones fuse together in the greater harmony of the matzah, of the Haggadah at large, in a celebration of reframing and the genius of the Seder. Inspiring, certainly a new way to look at a basic mitzvah like the matzah. But truth be told, we have only seen the tip of the iceberg. submerged below the surface in this observance of matzah at the Seder are all sorts of additional goodies, all sorts of additional delicious expressions of reframing. For example, let's think about what we do with the matzah, the yachatz. When one piece of the matzah, the small piece, serves as the poor man's bread, the poor man nibbles off a little piece, never allowing himself to enjoy the entire sack of everything he owns, the entire matzah. That is one piece of matzah. But then there is the other broken piece within the same matzah, the afikoman, the larger piece. And the afikoman, of course, is a stand-in for the Karban Pesach, for the Karban of our celebration. Is it not interesting that this one matzah contains the yin and the yang, the small piece of poor man's bread, along with the large piece of the afikoman? And we sit down at Motzi Matzah, and we eat the poor man's bread. But then, at Tzafon, the afikoman is brought to the table. The bread of redemption, which is in fact a piece of that very same matzah. That suffering and salvation, the ups and downs, this pendulum shift, which is life, the Jewish story, the human story, Gullus and Geula, are not as disparate as we may think they are. They form that swing of back and forth, which if lived with health, becomes a healthy pendulum shift. When the swing was in the direction of misery, it's difficult. But then when it swings in the promising direction, we have what to do with the past. We have a way to bring it all together. So hence, by master design, the afikoman of redemption joins the small shard of poverty. And this perspective is not simply our revelation of this evening, but I suggest one which has been primal to Jewish consciousness. You know, one of the most powerful expressions of Jewish consciousness is in the minhagim, in the customs, including customs which are not per se mandatory, but somehow the Jewish people just instinctually expressed feelings, sentiments. So I want to pick up on one of those most beloved childhood customs, and that is the hiding of the afikoman. Is that hiding the afikoman? Now, the conventional explanation given, really based on the Gemara, is to keep the children awake. First the child grabs the afikoman, then the child hides the afikoman. But is there more to it than that? Based on the perspective, based on this tapestry we are weaving this evening. Well, if the afikoman is the elusive half, think about it. We begin on the table with the small poor man's bread. That piece of life seems to be oh so readily available. Somehow that never gets lost. Suffering, all the deep, dark stuff always surface. They're never hard to find. What is it which is elusive? What is it that's hidden? The afikoman, the other half of the same matzah. Because in truth, as much as the small shard of poor man's bread, i.e., the deep, the dark, murky periods of life seem so omnipresent, we know that there is another half. And in fact, not an even half, but actually a larger piece. Joy, happiness, geula, is the larger piece of the purport, of the overall circle of life, as represented by the circle of this matzah. It's just elusive. It's just hidden. But in the end, it will be found. And when finally we hear the glee in the background, parent and child have been bantering, looking for that afikoman, and the afikoman, which was for so long hidden, now has been found. And we place it on the table, just as we place the other piece of the matzah. The matzah comes full circle. Life comes full circle. The hidden, elusive redemption, which we know is there. We just have to remain patient. We just have to find it. We'll come and we'll join together with the first piece, by design, all one big matzah. That I would suggest the one matzah with the two pieces is the story of life. One might believe at times their life consists of two biographies. There's the biography, there's the story of the ups, and there's the biography of the downs. But then it's a bifurcated life. It's not life anymore, because my life consists of both. And really, if we're honest, we know that the ups, the most rewarding achievements, are not despite the suffering, but are due to what I made of it. The grit, the drive, the growing on an neshama level. Certainly not easy, but so apart, one cannot separate the two elements of matzah onto two different matzos. They must be part of that one overall circle. And therefore, it is matzah, which is the prop on the Seder, the great setting, staging of what a Yetzias Mitzrayim, of how a Yetzias Mitzrayim should be celebrated, and how beyond we are to experience Gullus and Geula phenomena throughout life. One final delicious element to the reframing of matzah. Which perhaps will give that final spice, that final convincing, compelling power to this understanding. The term for the breaking of the matzah, yachatz. That term echoes of something. That term jars our mind of something. Something else in the Yetzias Mitzrayim story. Yachatz, from the word chatzi, half, is the same term as chatzos, midnight, when the Jewish people left Egypt. Now, what is the significance of the Jewish people's exodus, or to be technically correct, they were given permission to leave at midnight? What is the significance of that time marker, midnight? Well, it's interesting to note that the first half of the night, the Jewish people were slaves. The second half, they were free. That actually, one cannot give a clear calendar date when the Jewish people became free, because it was in the middle of that night, the 15th of Nisan, at midnight, they achieved freedom. The answer is the first part of the night they were slaves. The second part they were free. Apparently Hashem wanted the slavery and the freedom not to be separated by two different dates in the calendar, but actually to be experienced on the very same night. That on that night, that first Seder night, when the Jewish people were declared free at midnight, they had right in front of them the two parts of the night, slavery and freedom, the two parts of the human experience, of the Jewish experience, staring at them. And that is the power of Chatzos, bringing the two together. Yachatz, the same term now applied to the matzah, has a ring to it, has a resonance to it. The two parts of the night now captured by the two parts of the matzah as the one great circle of a life of harmony, a life of harmony where the dissonant, depressing notes are formative in terms of the grand symphony, the meaning, the way it all comes together at the end. Now, this idea, reframing, redemptive perspective regarding difficulties of the past, rather than sugarcoating the past or trying to pretend it didn't happen, to do something with it now that can allow me to grow from it and be at peace with it, because I could appreciate where it has brought me. This is not some abstraction. Any of us who have recovered, experienced true redemption in life, when we find ourselves no longer laden by the past, but we find ourselves whole with the past for what it is, which includes many different aspects, but I'll give one. Have we not all struggled with resentment? People wrong us, and in the end, the parties who wrong us do not always do teshuvah, at least in this lifetime. They don't always ask mechila. So how do I deal with that party? The ability to say, the party did what they did, and their growth is their world, their relationship to Hashem. But me, I could grow. I can be whole with the negative encounter with the person in the past, and they don't have a hold on me anymore because I've done something positive with the way they have wronged me. This is not an abstraction. This is something which you and I can all attest to, its power, to the degree we've done this. We all do this when we are living a Torah-tikka life, when we are living a healthy life. There is nothing more liberating than this. There is nothing more heuristic, more freeing. Because if I am simply presently free in my conditions, but the past is continuing to disturb me so, I am really not free. So the genius of the Seder lies not simply in the Geula, but in what it does to the Geula. And this theme is not limited to the matzah and the korech. It's really all over the place. As the child asking the manashtana noticed, perhaps not experiencing, not appreciating all of this depth, what the resolution is going to be. But the child is correct that gullus and geula, suffering and salvation and the interface, is all over the night. We come to understand why there is no contradiction here. So let me cite another example. And this is in a minhag observed in some communities. It might not be your own. There is a minhag in some communities recorded in the Shulchan Aruch to eat an egg at the Seder. This is aside from the egg on the Seder plate, to actually eat an egg. And a very obscure explanation is given by the Rama for this. He notes a calendar linkage. the night of the week in which the Seder fell out will always be the same night as Tisha B'Av of that year. Right? So if this year, Seder night is Motzei Shabbos Sunday, Tisha B'Av will be Motzei Shabbos Sunday. So in acknowledgement of Tisha B'Av and its mournful elements, which will occur on this same night of the week, an egg is eaten at the Seder. Now on the surface, this whole custom and this whole explanation seems so archaic and confusing. First of all, what is this calendar game? What is the significance to the fact that Tisha B'Av just happens to fall out on the same night of the week as the Seder? And why do we seemingly dilute the joy of the Seder by bringing up that in 5 months from now we're going to be mourning? Don't ruin the Seder. But in fact, we now understand we are not ruining the Seder at all. When at the Seder we think of Tisha B'Av, we are saying, on this night of redemption, we can even look at the Tisha B'Avs and the Tisha B'Av memories of the past and even the ones to be in 5 months, and we could say, we know from a Geula perspective we can make something positive from this. It is no calendar coincidence that it is the same night of the week, the Seder and Tisha B'Av, because at the Seder we are able to stare down Tisha B'Av and say, Tisha B'Av doesn't defeat us. Our enemies don't defeat us. We find Geula, we do something beautiful with all of it. And thus we crack open the egg. And I'm suggesting and really inviting the group to open your eyes and look at all the Seder observances that we know so well, and you will see how this powerful, potent notion of reframing is all over the place. Let's study another example. The dippings. Commentators note regarding the two dippings at the Seder, which we note in the Manishtana, the karpas dipped into the salt water and the mar dipped into charosis. Well, commentaries note that on one hand, the dipping was a custom associated with people of fortune who would season their food with dippings. But on the other hand, the dippings at the Seder have mournful elements. The karpas symbolizes the 600,000 men whose backs were broken under the mortar. The mar, of course, which we dip, symbolizes the bitterness of the slavery. And then the dip of the charosas itself has these seemingly contradictory symbolisms. On one hand, the Gemara says charosas is made from apples to remember the redemption of birth in Egypt under the apple tree, how the mothers gave birth to the children under the apple tree. On the other hand, the pasty substance of the charosas is supposed to symbolize the mortar. So here we have these seemingly mixed signals within the dipping. Mixed signals, which we're coming to understand, actually point to a unified message. And to take this understanding of the double dippings, the two dippings at the Seder, to new heights, let's think about the scriptural source for the two dippings. In the Yetzias Mitzrayim saga, you will find exactly two dippings. Firstly, on the way into Egypt, the sale of Yosef, the brothers dipped his cloak into blood. And then on the way out from Egypt, the Jewish people dipped the hyssop into blood when they affix the blood to the doorpost. Now, these two dippings in the Yetzias Mitzrayim story, which we generally do not connect because they are quite apart in the text, one in Sefer Bereishis, one in Sefer Shmos, the Yosef story, the Exodus, the two are remarkably similar. Think about Yosef's cloak, which was dipped into blood from a goat. And here we have when the Jewish people are leaving Egypt. Again, there is dipping into blood, which comes from either a goat or a sheep. The deja vu is powerful. Again, we Jewish people we have a long-term memory to our national consciousness. The stories of our ancestors, which might be a long time ago when you mark time historically, but spiritually, in Jewish consciousness, the events from the past are very, very present. We can only imagine that when the Jewish people on the way out from Egypt are dipping into the blood of a goat or a lamb, they are thinking about that dipping of Yosef's cloak into the blood of a goat and all the guilt which we as a Jewish people have for the sale of Yosef. These skeletons in the closet which brought us down to Egypt. We don't forget about it. Quite the contrary. We think about it again on the way out from Egypt. This deja vu is exactly the point. We are reframing all of that stuff that now when we are leaving Egypt, having grown as a nation, we grew from that low period, the sale of Yosef. We're no longer stigmatized by the dipping into the blood of a goat. Now this becomes the symbol of our redemption. And hence we have two dippings, double dippings in the Yetzias Mitzrayim story. With this in mind, when we sit down to a Seder every year and we do exactly two dippings, the correlation is uncanny. Two dippings at the Seder with both elements of suffering and salvation, just like the original two dippings of reframing in the story. When we connect the dots this way and we see the picture, the broad panorama coming to light. It's beautiful to behold. It's delightful to appreciate and own for ourselves these observances at a Seder and how much wisdom, how much symbolism lies below the surface when we put the pieces together this way and take a step back. One final observance at the Seder, which I would like to study tonight and see how it underscores the very same message, the promise of reframing. The Dalad Kosos, the four cups of wine. Now, classically, we're taught that the four cups of wine, the four glasses of wine, are supposed to symbolize freedom, the ability to drink a mashke chashuv, a beverage of prominence, like a free man does. And moreover, the four glasses, which the Yerushalmi Pesachim tells us correlates to the four expressions of redemption, Votzeisi, Vitzalti, Vegaalti. But that's actually only part of the puzzle. The same Gemara tells us there is another explanation, another layer of symbolism to the four cups. It tells us that we are supposed to remember the four glasses of Paro. That when we recall the story of the first Paro in the Yosef story and the story of the royal butler, four times the Chumash speaks of Paro's glass, the Kos Paro Biyadi, the Eschado Samal Kos Paro, the Atenas Akos Al Kaf Paro, the Nasata Kos Paro Biyato. Four times the glass of Paro is mentioned, and therefore we commemorate the four glasses of Paro with the four glasses of the Seder. Now, on the face of it, this sounds strange. Paro merits? Paro's glasses merit commemoration at the Seder? And then the Gemara continues even more provocatively and says, the four glasses are supposed to commemorate the four Gullius, the four exiles, the four kingdoms who will subjugate Israel, the Jewish people. Babylonia, Persia, Greece, and Rome. Why are they figuring in? Why are these negative memories, the four glasses of Paro, the four kingdoms who will subjugate Israel, why are they seemingly diluting the pristine toast of freedom, the four expressions of redemption? This question is, of course, rhetorical, my friends. By now we understand. Remembering the goblets of Paro, remembering our enemies and their drinking parties, and finding a way no longer to cringe from the thought of Paro's drinking party, of the four enemies of Israel, but finding a way to say, ultimately, we have a toast of freedom. What a richer toast of Dalet Kosos. What a richer Dalet Kosos when these Dalet Kosos incorporate the painful memories of the past as represented by the four goblets of Paro and the four enemies who will subjugate Israel. So tonight we took quite a few of the observances at the Seder, the Korich sandwich, the matzah from multiple perspectives, the afikoman, the dippings and the Dalet Kosos, and we saw the sheer wisdom of the Jewish people, of Jewish consciousness, how in these seemingly simple behaviors, we have this rich, promising notion of fusion, of blending, woven right in a really a harmonious message throughout the night. That seen this way, the child's question in the Manashtana, and when we mention this explanation that the child's confused by the seemingly contradictory messages, I don't know that the child even is able to articulate that so clearly. The Manashtana is a very simple question, but it points to some deeper confusion. On the surface, there is a seeming confusion, the Seder night. Suffering, salvation, which is it? But if we are observing these observances properly, if we are internalizing what they are about, we can respond to these questions. We can own the Seder night, how the seemingly mixed messages could not have pointed to a more cohesive message, to a more harmonious message. May we continue to find new meanings in the Seder of old to inspire us. More broadly, may we take this message of reframing beyond the Seder to how we live the story of life, the experience of life, to allow our personal gullus and geula periods and ups and downs to come together in something beautiful. A geula, which is all the more beautiful because it came through the growth of gullus. It came through the grit. It came through the down periods. And then we can truly be free, not stigmatized by the past, but wholer and all the more complete by the past. Thank you very much. Warmest wishes of Chag Kosher V'Sameach.
Thank you very much.